pedagogical review of different formulations of general relativity, both the action principle and the equations of motion, that underlie modern or contemporary work both in classical gravity and quantum gravity. Well, thank you. New. Almost everything I have to say is in this review article here. I'll try to mention who some of the original work is done by, but I won't, don't hold me to it. The main idea is to try to just be pedagogical and present the main results, the main ideas. I will leave many of the derivations as homework problems, but none of them are difficult. In fact, the whole point of this set of work, so just to say what I'm going to talk about. So my understanding is that you've had a review of the basis of differential forms and general relativity, or in the main case, I'm assuming that you know it. But I'll review the main things about frame fields, spin connections, and the relationship to curvature. Then I'm going to talk about the Pauli formulation, which I imagine many people know, but just to make sure it wasn't covered in the last lecture in the series, so just to make sure that everybody knows it and is up to date. And up till here, Pontine is somewhere in the 1920s, or something like that, 1930s. So this is all very old-fashioned stuff. Then the idea is to introduce you to a bunch of stuff, which is all interrelated with the Lansky action, the Holst action, the Ashtekar form of the variables, both for the equations of motion and for the Hamiltonian formulation. And the reasons to do this are several. One of them is that the stuff is actually very simple. That is, the equations of general relativity, as you usually write them down, are infinite order equations in the basic variables. That is, they involve both the metric and its square root and its inverse. So there's an infinite order if you actually try to make sense of the Einstein equations, say, in a computer program. Or alternatively, if you try to quantize it and make sense of the Einstein equations as operator equations, you have an infinite order problem of ordering, operator ordering and regularization because you're dealing with an operator and the a matrix of operators and the inverse of that matrix of operators as well, the square root and so forth. The work by Plobansky, Sen, Ashtekar, etc., the effect was all to reduce the Einstein's equations to some simple polynomials by introducing auxiliary variables. And that makes the problems of solving the equations for practical circumstances much easier. And I'll give just one example. There are all the standard space-time that's been done, but I'll talk about the Sitter space-time along the way just to give one example. So one reason to do it is that once you know this stuff, one tends not to go back. That is, most of us who are acquainted with this stuff do all the calculations of whatever we're going to do in this language because it is so much simpler. The other reason to do it is that there's by now, since the mid-1980s, a large body of literature on quantum gravity for which all of this is assumed. And there seems to be, therefore, a barrier. There is a barrier to getting involved in contemporary work in spin foam models, Tiemann's work in loop quantum gravity, et cetera. Anything that anybody in the domain of quantum gravity outside of string theory is doing, almost all of it takes this as background. And therefore, a reason to do this is to help you over the entry, because this is basically a transition in terms of notation as well as in terms of some basic results which are then used over and over again. So, as I was saying, I'm going to try talk about up to here, the Pravansky formulation, the Palatine formulation is old-fashioned. It's in all the textbooks in general relativity, but I want to make sure that everybody knows it. Then I'm going to talk about the Holst action, some notation about self-dual, taking duals and self-dual, et cetera, called self-duality. Then the Pravansky action, which was introduced by Pravansky before any of this other stuff, but was not noticed by anybody. It was actually, the papers by Pravansky were in the mid-1960s, but nobody read them or was aware of them. And so their content was rediscovered by people trying to put the Ashtekar formulation in terms of an action principle. And I'll talk about that history a little bit when I get to it. Then I'll mention De Sitter space-time as a simple example. And when you mention De Sitter space-time in this context, you immediately see a role for Chern-Simons theory. And Chern-Simons theory is something that comes up all over condensed matter physics. It plays roles in string theory, plays roles in theories of brains and membranes, et cetera. And I think it's not so well known that there's a deep relationship between Chern-Simons theory and the basic kinematics of De Sitter space-time. So that's what I hope to accomplish. The extras down here, if there's time, one is from Malcolm, which is a rederivation of the fact that the De Sitter space-time is hot, which just falls out of this notation in a few lines. So that's not new, but it's simpler than the way it was done 20 years ago. And then since there is a workshop on holography going on, I can talk about how at least one version of the holographic principle looks in this language. And this is pedagogical. This is primarily oriented to the students, who I see are sitting mostly in the front row. So please stop me. Don't be embarrassed. I won't be embarrassed the fact that there are fancy people in the back row. We're going to ignore them. And we're just going to go step by step. Okay? So the basics of general relativity in the formulation that you learned last time are that there is a frame field, which is a one form, and I'm introducing here my notation. A goes from 0, 1, 2, 3, and it labels the frames. And I'm not notating that these are one forms. And if people are not happy with my not notating the forms, then just tell me and I will put Greek indices in. So when I notate forms, they will have Greek indices like that. And the idea is that general relativity is a theory in D dimensions, D frame fields, which are defined to be orthonormal to each other, that defines what the metric is. And therefore, the metric, Gene, you knew I will put the indices in, is constructed like this from these orthonormal forms, where this is the ordinary metric of Minkowski space-time. And what these forms do is they refer space-time indices to the tangent space notated as Minkowski space-time. So what these forms allow you to do is take a vector field in space-time and express it as something which has a free index, which is a Lorentz index, sitting in the tangent space of the space-time at a point. Okay? And a thing that you need to know is that the determinant of E is the same thing as the square root of the determinant of E we knew, and will just be written as E. By the way, I'm going to always do the notation in four dimensions with no supersymmetry, but everything I do extends. If somebody wants, I can explain a few things that don't extend. Everything in one way or another extends to higher dimensions and to supersymmetry if people want, just because supersymmetry came up in touch if people want. So there doesn't seem to be any barrier to extending to higher dimensions and supersymmetry. Going to lower dimensions immediately trivializes, that is, one sees in this notation immediately the general relativity in 2 plus 1 dimensions is a theory with no local degrees of freedom, which is one of the advantages of this notation. Okay. They're also.
Get it on my side.
Thank you. I will work in both Euclidean and Lorentzian signatures, and I will, for ease of clarity, I will do both at the key points. And now is, of course, the time to say that factors of minus signs, twos, and i's are no, there are no promises of that. But I'm trying to be careful. Okay. I believe that they're all correct in the indirect that I'm working from. Okay. Now, for vector fields, so this object is VA, for vector fields of that kind, there's a notion of a covariant derivative, del mu VA, is the vector field of internal Lorentz indices, which is the ordinary derivative plus a one-form field, omega mu AB, DB. And this plays the role of a Yang-Mills field. So this is a one-form, this omega. And if I put the indices upstairs, it's anti-symmetric. And therefore, this is valued in SO3-1 or SO4 in the case of the Euclidean signature. And this can be thought of, this omega can be thought of as a Yang-Mills field for the Lorentz group plus base term. And given it, one can construct a curvature tensor, which is a two-form, which, and now I'm assuming everybody knows what D's are, so it's D omega AB plus, and I don't promise about the half, but omega AC wedge omega CD, and this is a two-form, and that's the curvature two-form. Okay. And I believe that this is roughly as far as you got last time. Is that right? Okay. Okay, good. So any questions up to here? This is my starting point. Okay. Now, Palatini wrote an action for general relativity of the following form. The integral, now, everything in general relativity is diffeomorphism invariant, or if you prefer the language, generally covariant. And that means that the things that we integrate have to be a four-form. And there are three simple four-forms one can write made out of R's and E's. And they are EA, wedge EB, wedge R, CD, epsilon, AB, CD. And that generally has a coefficient of 1 over E's constant. Okay. And R here is a function of the omegas. And the omegas are independent of the E's. So what's novel here is this is an action principle, which is the function of both the frame fields and the covariant derivatives or connection coefficients. So one can write that term. One can also write a term epsilon AB. Sorry, why am I? That's the thing that I'm leaving out. One can also, so let me just explain. This epsilon, did you do the epsilon ABCD?
No.
So epsilon ABCD is totally anti-symmetric. Anti-symmetric epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is equal to 1. And it's just a bunch of numbers. It is the total anti-symmetrizer in the Minkowski spacetime in the tangent space. Why is it here? It's there, we used to say, because of parity. We have something which is E wedge R, which is a four form of one form wedge, and two form. And that all has negative parity, because if you can think there's an epsilon, what is going on here is there's an epsilon mu nu alpha beta, e nu a, e nu b, r alpha beta, c d. And so this is anti-symmetrizing, and this well, I forget what this object is called, this is the manifold epsilon, induces a negative parity. It changes sign under parity operation. So, but general relativity is not a chiral theory. General relativity is even under parity, and therefore you need to balance it with another epsilon, which also changes sign under parity. So there are two anti-symmetries here. And on the other hand, since we're just writing an action, why not write the other term? So the other term is just EA wedge EB wedge RAB of omega. And let's give that a coefficient. We're about to forget about that for a couple of blackboards. But that's, notice that that term is just as simple. And this term has odd parity because under change of parity, the epsilon changes sign, which is in the wedges. But the A's and B's are just contracted here. And we will come back to that in a couple of blackboards. And then the last thing that I can write is just something which is in the E's, EA wedge EB wedge EC wedge ED. And here I don't have a choice. I have to contract it with the epsilon, otherwise it would be zero. And this has a constant devoted to it, which is a famous name. That's the topological constant that they say. So this is the Palatini action. And this is an elegant way to express the field equations of general relativity, that is, by varying it. And so let me do that. And again, we're, you know, the people who already know this, I'll come back to things that you don't know in a few minutes.
Can you say something about higher order terms in curvature?
I could, yes. So what he's referring to is that there could be terms of things like RAB wedge RCD, epsilon ABCD, or the one we've been contracted. Let me not talk about those right now, but they could be there. Mm-hmm. Well, you're allowed to do many things, but now I think with the two R terms, with the epsilon and the direct contraction, I've written everything in polynomial.
But you could have derivatives of R.
Slightly different, but ordinary GR, because I can make all kinds of powers of R.
Oh, no, you can make anything you can say in ordinary GR, you can say.
Yeah, that's what I'm struggling with.
Yes, okay. It happens to be, let me say it the other way. Okay. It happens to be that this term and this term, which I'm going to show you give general relativity, are nice and polynomial, which is not true of the Einstein action, which is so ugly I'm not even going to write it down. Okay.
I'm just asking how you get a four form out of many Riemann curvatures.
You have to explicitly introduce epsilons, and then you have to take ratios of ones. Okay, so let's talk about the Einstein equations. So if I take the equations of motion first, so this is Palatini. First, I vary by E, and I'm going to put the frame in the form indices back in, so I'm going to remember that there's an epsilon here. And the variation has two terms, because there's a variation from here and a variation from here. This one, they both have an epsilon mu alpha beta in front of it. I'm just going to take the first E off, so that means that there's an E mu B. There's, I don't need the wedge because that's implicit in the epsilon notation, R alpha beta CD, and this is a function of omega. And there were two E's I might have varied, so let me put a 1 over 2 GU in there, and a 1 over GU. I'm not including matter, but I'll say a few words in a minute about what would happen if you included matter. And then let me put a 1 over 4 here. I vary, there are four factors of E to pick up. And so inside the epsilon is an EB mu, an EC alpha, an ED beta. epsilon A, B, C, D. And that's the result of varying the action with respect to the E.
Brackets in the wrong place. Wrong square brackets.
No, I think it's in the right. I want my epsilon outside. And, oh, you're right. You're right. Both epsilons are outside the brackets. And if we're being precise, these indices are lower. Okay. And this is equal to zero. Now, usually, when those of you who are familiar with varying the Einstein action, the curvature in the Einstein action is a function of the Christoffel symbols, which are a function of the metric. And now you have to have a long story about the other terms that come from varying the metric inside the Christoffel symbol. Here, there is no such story because the omegas are independent of the e's. So let's look at the equation that you get by varying with respect to the omega, and I'll take, say, omega alpha CD and vary with respect to that. What is going on here? So what's going on here is inside of here is a derivative of omega, and then there's an omega square term, omega sitting inside the R.
You missed out the lambda, I think, in this.
I did miss out the lambda. Thank you. And again, I'm not making promises about factors of two and so forth. But what I want is to see how the logic works. The omega sits here with the derivative around it. So when we vary, we integrate by parts and we bring the derivative around here. There are two E's, so this, to start off with, the superstructure here, there's an epsilon mu alpha beta, there's an epsilon A, B, C, D. That sits outside of everything because derivatives go through them. And then I have a derivative on the two E's, but these are both anti-symmetrized, so I can write this as an E mu A, and then the derivative beta E mu B plus et cetera. So we start to get a structure like that. Then from the omega term, there is a term here, this dot 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 is a term with an omega where the derivative is. And what that does, because there is justice in the world, is convert this to a covariant derivative of the kind that I wrote there, because these E's are each of them, they're one form, but they're divided in the Lorentz group, and therefore the covariant derivative acts on them as one form. So there's an anti-symmetry, so the covariant derivative is well defined on the forms. So we have a structure like this. And this is a condition on omega. These are as many equations as there are omegas because we vary, these are the equations of motion gotten from varying the omegas. And so what one wants to do is solve these equations for omega. And this is, I'm not going to write the full answer and I'm not going to do this for you. This is the first homework problem. But the answer of this is that omega alpha AB is a particular function of E inverses, which I'll define in a minute because I forgot two derivatives and E's, and I'll just leave that in quotes. That is, these equations, of whom, how many of them are? There are four because the omegas are one forms, times six because they're valued in the Lorentz group, which is six generators. So these are 24 equations for 24 unknowns, which are the omegas, and they can be completely solved to express the omegas as functions of the derivatives of the e's. And the inverse of the e's are objects that look like this, e mu a, defined by their contraction is just the Kronecker delta. So I'll leave that as a homework problem. I won't actually need the details of this formula, but I'll need a fact about it in a little while. So I'm not going to write out the details. I think, you wrote this out last night.
I did, I informed last night.
Okay. So it's a long ugly formula with three terms in it. It's not a formula you could guess, but it's a formula that you can work out. Now, the fact that I need
about... That's slightly disruptive.
Yes.
There's another solution to these equations, which is E mu A equals zero.
Yes.
I always like that solution.
Thank you. Thank you. You're going to earn the present you're getting at the end if you get to the end. There is a big advantage of this formalism and the formalisms that follow, which is that the actions are polynomials in the basic variables. I stated that. Which means, consequently, that the equations of motion are polynomials in the basic variables. Okay. Which means that, in addition to the solutions that reproduce, and I haven't said that yet, but that will reproduce general relativity for a metric gotten from the Frank fields this way, there are always other solutions where, for example, the E's are zero, so the G's are zero, or where, for example, the E's may not all be zero, but the determinant of the E's may be zero. Okay. These are not solutions of general relativity, because to write the field equations of general relativity, you need to have both G and its inverse, which means the determinant of G is assumed to be not zero. Now, this is the price that you pay by making equations of motion polynomial. And by polynomial, they use only the E's, that is, they use only the G's and never the inverses of the G's. The inverse of the G's come in, as I just alluded to, by solving these equations of motion. Because you need the inverse of the E's to write the omegas. Okay. But there are always those other solutions, and that's the price you pay, and that brings worries and issues, which I will not discuss, but I'm happy to discuss at the end. So, for example, if you take any of the formulations I'm talking about as a starting point for quantization, you should always worry, if I succeed somewhere, am I accidentally quantizing the sector of the theory where the determinant of the metric is zero? And that question has driven a lot of research, and I think that there are results which are of that kind, and there are other results where we know the determinant of the metric is not zero. Okay. Yes?
Are you working at manifold with no boundary right now?
Thank you very much. Another thing I forgot to say, but I'm assuming my manifold is of the form of a compact sigma plus time, where sigma is a three-dimensional compact manifold. In my outline, at the very end, if I get to it, I will discuss boundary terms and boundary conditions and so forth. And there's a beautiful story about boundary terms and boundary conditions. It goes along with this, but I'm dropping it down. Okay. Now, if I push this that high, can everybody still see it? Okay. Now, let's take the solutions of this equation of motion, the good solutions, and not Malcolm's solutions, and plug them into here. And so I'm going now, I want to think about the curvature true form R mu nu AB as a function of omega, which is written as a function of the E's when I plug back in. And so this is what I will call omega of E, and I'll try to always notate it like this. And this is related to the ordinary Riemann curvature tensor in the following way. If I change indices, so I make these I change these back to manifold indices using the inverse of the Frank field, then this is R mu nu, and you know what? I'm just gonna not use the inverse and bring all the indices downstairs. This is R mu nu alpha beta, which is the curvature tensor with one index lowered. Naturally, it has an index up here, but that's equivalent to lowering the index. And that is this as a function only of the metric in the standard form that you learned when you studied Riemannian geometry or first course in general relativity. So this object here is the curvature tensor. And it also is the case that this particular combination, so let me write out what I need there. What I have there is epsilon e nu alpha beta. Let me remember my other epsilon a, b, c, d. And here I have e b nu r alpha beta c, d. And now I'm going to have r, which is a function of omega, and e. And this whole object, what are its free indices? It has a free index nu, and it has a free index a. So let me get rid of that free index a and change it to a free index alpha. And that object now has two manifold indices, alpha and nu. And that is g alpha nu, which is the Einstein tensor, i.e. r alpha nu minus 1/2 delta alpha nu, the curvature scalar. So that is the thing that should be there in the Einstein equations. And again, I'll leave both of these as things to check for homework. And by the way, all of these, for example, are in Misenthal and Wheeler. They're in Wald. So the details of these calculations are easily found. Okay. Another thing let me notice is that this object, R mu nu alpha beta, has a symmetry where I anti-symmetrize on all those three of the indices. That's one of the Bianchi identities, and I'm not going to derive that for you, but let me just remind you of that. Okay. So then when I put the solutions of these equations of motion into here, and then this object here becomes also the cosmological constant term. Just for completeness, I'll say that as well. Let's see, I must have done u, v, alpha c, e, beta, d, and I want to change the free index A into an alpha, and that is up to some number, which I'm going to let you compute, delta alpha nu. And so this equation becomes the Einstein equation. That is, that equation becomes R mu alpha, lowering that index, minus 1/2, G mu alpha R minus lambda G mu alpha equals 0, which are the Einstein equations. Okay. So this action principle, leaving out this term, is an action principle for the Einstein equations.
The second line on that board there, the index on the right where you got g alpha nu, shouldn't that be a mu? It looks like looking at the indices on the left hand side, you contract it up a nu.
You're right. And therefore, this means again. And therefore, that's okay. Okay, thank you. Okay. Now, let me put that up there. And now, that's all textbook stuff, and now I'm going to turn to stuff which is relatively recent. And the first thing that I want to look at is to put back this term here. Putting in that term is called the Holst action, and I actually have no idea who Holst is or when Holst is.
I don't know. He was a complainant.
Because this appeared, logically, it's the next step, but it actually appeared at the end of the sequence of results that I'm introducing. So I don't know. It might be. There's an astrophysicist called Dan Holst, but I don't think it's him.
There's a handful of references to him in Spiral.
This Holst.
That Holst.
Yeah.
I don't know. Really,
yeah. So anyway, Holst noted the following thing, and it must have been noticed before, which is that you can add this term without affecting the equations of motion. And let me just talk you through that without going through the details. I'm going to try to do it just by erasing and adding to the equations on this board here. Okay. This term has the same structure as this term, except that where the epsilon is here, there's a direct contraction. So that means that there's an extra term here, and that term looks like gamma is still the big manifold index on the outside, but instead it's going to look like E nu B R alpha beta A B, like that, of omega equals zero. So we get an extra term proportional to gamma, and I better put a gamma over 2 there. Here, again, there's a term which works the same exact way, except instead of this epsilon, there is a direct contraction. Okay. And I'm actually going to notate that a little bit differently. I'm going to say there's the epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then here there's an object which looks like E A B C D, and then plus gamma eta A C eta B D. Just notating directly the contraction there. Okay. Now, what effect does this have on the solutions of the equations of motion? And again, I'll leave this for a homework. This is still the non-degenerate solution of these equations. That is, omega equals the omega, which is a function of the E, is still the only solution of these equations. And adding this extra complication of these extra indices does not change that fact. And I'm not going to prove that. That's a bunch of playing around with indices. But that's the key point. That's unchanged. The second thing is that when you put into this term omega of E, then this object vanishes because of this symmetry. That is, the object that we have here, now E, let me write it out, epsilon E nu alpha beta E nu B R A B of omega of E turns out to be related to R mu nu alpha beta with nu and beta contracted. And because of that anti-symmetry, that's zero. And that's what Holst noticed. Okay. Now, therefore, here's something interesting, which I have been pondering for a while, so I'm just going to say something. This is outside of pedagogy. Okay. I started with an action principle for general relativity, which I argued had to be even under parity because the field equations for general relativity are odd under parity. What we've done here is introduce a term which is odd under parity to the action for general relativity. So the action is now no longer even under parity. But because of these two facts, solving the equations of motion in this, and because of this extra identity here, the equations of motion are even under parity nonetheless. This term here, for people who are familiar with Yang-Mills theory, this term here is very analogous to something like an FAB wedge, FAB term in Yang-Mills theory that is a purely topological addition to the action. And this parameter gamma is analogous to the theta angle in Yang-Mills theory. And indeed, there's a lot to ponder there. Recently, Stefan Alexander, Jim Gates, a number of other people have been wondering whether, in some sense, gamma should be made into a field and whence it would become like an axion and play a role as an axion. And Jim Gates is claiming that that axion is related to axions and string theory and so forth. But there's an interesting opportunity there to get parity odd physics into gravitation, which is what these people have been interested in exploring.
Lee, how does it look like that forced action in what you call the manifold indices?
That's a homework problem. I do know the answer, but let me leave that as a homework problem. Okay. Now, if you accept that much, let me take you on the route to Lebesgue. And the route to Lebesgue comes from realizing that there are some special things that happen in the case that gamma is plus or minus I in the case of Lorentzian signature. And to explain this, I have to just give you some kinematics about the notion of self-duality and anti-self-duality in Lorentzian spacetimes. So this is now, I have to do a little bit of discourse on self-duality and self-duality. Okay. So I'm going to be interested in things of the form of tensors in Minkowski space, which are anti-symmetric. And so these are living in the Lie algebra of SO3-1. And what I'm going to say for the next few minutes is special to 3 plus 1 or 4 dimensions. And that's because on such objects, this notion of the dual of A, which is 1/2 epsilon AB CD, A, C, D. And that's called taking the dual. And we're working entirely in the Minkowski space-time from the general relativity point of view. This is we're working in the tangent space using the Frank fields to define space-time indices. Now, given, so is everybody here? This is this epsilon. I'm raising and lowering indices always with respect to the Minkowski metric. So these are just zeros and ones. So for example, A dual 0, 1 is A 2, 3. Okay. So you can ask, are there objects S, A, B, which are eigenvalued? This is a map from the space of anti-symmetric tensors to the space of anti-symmetric tensors. And one can ask, are there eigenvectors of this map, that is, objects that transform into themselves? And it turns out that there are. The eigenvalues are plus or minus I in Minkowski signature. And the reason is that star star on A is minus A 2, because of the minus sign in Lorentzian metric. And so since it's square changes sign, its eigenvalues have to be plus or minus I. And these are objects of the form A plus or minus AB, which are A, AB, plus or minus A dual AB. And I think eventually this is one half there. What's happening when we are taking the self-dual part and anti-self-dual part? And from a group theory point of view, what we're doing is noticing that in the Lie algebra of S013, it's actually the sum of two, let me call them SU2 algebras, SU2 plus SU2, where this is conventionally called the left SU2 and this is called the right SU2. Roughly speaking, if this has rotation generators and boost generators, so these are things like Lij, if spatial indices are ijk is 1, 2, 3, and so I'm just wondering how much to notate this. A boost generator bi is a Lorentz generator L0i, and these guys are of the form of rotations plus boosts, and these are the form of rotations minus boosts. So the Lorentz algebra in 3 plus 1 dimensions has the case of factoring into two commuting algebras, one of which is rotations plus boosts, the other is rotations minus boosts, and we call them SU2 left and SU2 right. Unless somebody asks me, I'm not going to introduce spinner indices, but I should mention the fact that left-handed chiral spinners transform under the Lorentz group just as representations of SU2 left, and right-handed chiral spinners transform just under rotations of SU2 right. So if you're parallel transporting Lyell spinners, you only need actually to parallel transport, say, the left-handed connection. You don't need to parallel transport the full connection. Okay. Any questions about that? I just actually compressed a whole lot of stuff into a few minutes, but this is key stuff. So please ask.
I mean, that's about there's some eyes flying around.
There's some eyes flying around. So help me with the eyes.
I guess there must be an eye in the second former at the bottom of the where you're standing. I mean, left, yeah, here as well.
Here?
I guess. And then there's one in the A plus minus former.
Yes. Okay. I was going to look at my notes at this point and remember where the eyes were, but since you have a good audience. Thank you. Thank you. This is all with Euclidean signature. Everything is very similar, but the dual has a plus sign, so there are no i's. Okay. So, any questions about the structure so far? I don't think I need this. So.
From the Holtz term, you said it's like theta FF dual.
Mm-hmm. It's similar. It's not similar. Precisely like, because there's also, of course, an RR dual, which is a different term.
So I was wondering, does this get any support? I mean, is there a winding number associated with it so that gamma gets compact, or is there no support?
I believe there is support, but I'm not sure. There's certainly support for R wedge, R dual.
Yeah, but yeah. For this, you know.
You mean, are there Euclidean solutions,
yes,
on which this has support?
Is it quanta? Is there some more information about
this? Let me go a little bit further, and then let's come back to that.
I don't think it's a topological invariant.
It's not a topological invariant. It's not a topological invariant. But nonetheless, it plays an interesting role, but let me develop a bit more. Okay. A last thing I want to do here is apply this self-duology to the spin connection we've been working with. And so I can split omega, I can take its plus part, and I'm going to call that omega mu AB. And similarly, we could take its minus part, but I'm not going to need to talk about that. And let me introduce some notation here, which will be helpful. A mu 0, 1, by being self-dual, is really omega 0, 1 plus I omega 2, 3. And therefore, I'm going to just call that A mu 1. That is, this is really, what I'm doing is this is really valued in SU2, because I'm taking the plus part, so I can talk about it with an SU2 index. And there are various ways to save where I runs from 1, 2, and 3. There are various ways to say this in terms of decomposing gamma matrices. I'm happy to say it a number of different ways. If I say go to a chiral representation for gamma I, it looks like sigma I, like this, then in this notation, A is being represented as A plus A minus. That is A value in the Lie algebra. I don't know that. Did I mean that? Yes, I could mean that. So that A is living in either the purely SU2 plus part or purely SU2 minus part. And then, having done that, R mu nu AB can also be split into its plus part and its minus part. Notice that because the plus and minus part, notice that generally A plus plus A minus is back equal to the full A again. So anything with anti-symmetric Lorentz indices can be split into its plus part and its minus part. And R plus turns out to be just a function of the old plus part of omega, that is, it's just a function of A. And R minus is a function of just omega minus, and the minus part of omega is also the complex conjugate of A. So, and I a little bit took a shortcut here, so let me just repeat to make sure. I can distinguish, I can break omega into a part, omega plus AB plus omega minus AB. And I can split R, the curvature, into R plus and R minus. And the plus part of the curvature is a function only of the plus part of the omega, which I'm following notation and calling A. And also the minus part of omega is, of R is a function of just the minus part of omega. And then what R mu nu I looks like, the plus part, since it's valued just in SU2, I can use an SU2 index. And it looks just like dA I plus epsilon I j k a j with a k. That is, the plus part of R just looks like a Yang-Yills field for SU2. Okay. Now, having...
Is it really SO2C in this case? The code?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. It's really complexified, that is, because of these I's here, this object is complex and this object is complex. So they really live in the complexification of that situation.
I'm a little bit confused because I thought basically what you do is you're looking at the curvature describing the non-triviality of parallel transport, normally of vectors, but you're dividing this vector into the left and right-handed spinners. So you're looking at the non-triviality of parallel transport expressed through the curvature tensor for the left right spinners and the right right spinners. And so I was expecting it's SU2, but if it's SL2C, then that's the whole thing again, right? SL2C is basically SL2C.
Very good. Very good. So because of that confusion, I think let me proceed in two steps. And I hope this will clarify things. Let's do the Euclidean case of what I'm about to do next. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'll state clearly what's true about the Euclidean case, and then let's come back to the Lorentzian case and address and clear up that confusion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, another way of saying that is positive geometrically is complex. So that A plus actually does have everything. A plus does have everything in it because it's complex.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The complex quantity of A plus is A minus, so you have everything in A plus.
Okay. So in the Euclidean case, A star is defined the same way. A star star is equal to A. And I'm dropping indices. A plus minus is now 1/2 A plus A star plus or minus. And SO4 is SO3 plus SO3 left and right. And everybody stays real. There's no lines anywhere in the Euclidean case. So the four-dimensional Euclidean rotation group splits into two SU2. The generators of SL4 split into two generators, two subalgebras of SL3 and SL3 dual. And then everything that I wrote here is true. The only thing that's not true is that omega minus and omega plus are now independent. So let's think about what that means. That means for each omega, there are six objects in a Lorentz group, and that splits into three, which are the plus ones, which live in an SU2, and another three, which are the minus ones, that live in another SU2. And these are completely independent of each other. And let's walk through that case, which is a little simpler, and then we'll go back to Lorentz
and real.
Yes. Okay. Now, let me now consider the case where gamma is 1, and go back to the Hulse action. And we see that, let me rewrite the Hulse action with that Hulse term. And let me make some liberal use of the star operator, where every time I'm using an epsilon, I'm really using the star operator. So a way to write the Hulse action is the integral of EA wedge EB wedge R dual AB plus gamma times R AB. Because this epsilon here really just makes this the dual, using the language that I've used. And there is no such dual in the term proportional to the gamma, which is the Hulse term. So if gamma equals 1, then this is just the integral of EA wedge EB wedge R plus AB, which we've said is a function just of omega plus. Okay. So, and plus the cosmological constant term. The cosmological constant term I can write is lambda times just E, which is the determinant of E. That doesn't change.
So what does the argument provide? R plus was only a function of omega plus?
You have to do the calculation, but roughly speaking, R of any omega is of the form of d omega plus a commutator of omegas in the Lie algebra. That's true for any Yang-Mills field. And so if it happens that the Lie algebra splits into two pieces, each of which commute with each other, then if I take the projection here into the plus part, which lives inside of an SU2, okay, that's going to be d of omega plus. And then there's a term here, which is roughly speaking omega plus commutator omega plus omega plus commutator omega minus. Because the omega plus is generated at the SU2 left, the commutator also lives in the SU2 left. And because the SU2 left and right are commuting, the omega plus and the omega minus terms vanish in the commutator. So now the host action is here, and it's just a function of the plus piece. And I've already demonstrated for you that this has the same field equations as general relativity. So the interesting thing is that the action principle for general relativity can be a function just of E, and not the full connection, but only the SU2 part of the connection. Okay. And that is takes a little bit of getting used to, but I already told you generally what it has to do with is I told you that adding this Holtz term doesn't change the fact that the solution of these equations is that omega is related to E. In the particular case that gamma is equal to 1, in the Euclidean case, then the only thing that's in this equation is omega plus, because the epsilon plus 1 times the diffractions just pick out the plus piece. So the only thing that's in this is omega plus, and what you get is an equation that omega plus is equal to the plus piece of the expression of E's and their derivatives. And that, again, that's an addendum of the homework problem that we already have. And that's, again, it's something that you have to check 5 different ways and make sure that you really believe. Because now the field equations are a function of all of the omega, but the action is a function just of half of the omega. Okay. Now, that is halfway to the Lebesgue formulation. Let's see, where do I have some more convergent blackboard? Let me now get you to where Lebesgue was in 1965.
Is it that in the Euclidean signature case, you can write the action with the right-handed only, and the equation of motion will have both?
Yes.
Okay, that was the statement.
Yes. Okay. So let me start from where we are with gamma equal 1, and let me, I'll continue to the Euclidean case, then I'll put the eyes back and clarify what happens with the Lorentzian case. And here I have a structure EA wedge EB wedge R plus. So that is, has a structure of R plus duals. R plus AB, which is a function just of omega plus. And I can put the E wedge E wedge E wedge E term in as well. The next thing that to notice is that this can be, this action can be further simplified. And why it can be further simplified is the following. Let me consider this structure here. And let me notice something about this structure. This structure is a two-form. So let me define it. Sigma AB is EA with EB. But let me notice that we don't need all of this two-form because it's contracted into the plus part of the curvature. And what that means is contracted into the plus part of the curvature, if you like, is that there's a projection operator, and you can prove it's a projection operator, sitting here. That is what it means if there's a plus there is that there's something that looks like delta delta plus epsilon stuck in between the index contractions. And this object, so let me maybe take this object out and play with it on the blackboard for a moment. P plus or minus ABCD equals delta AC delta BD. It's on anti-symmetric tensors, plus or minus epsilon ABCD, okay, is a projection operator on the space of anti-symmetric tensors to anti-symmetric tensors. That is P plus is P plus, and P plus, P minus is equal to zero, and the identity is P plus P minus. And what this action really is R A B C D with P plus, that projection operator, A B C D hidden inside here. And since P is a projection operator, it's equal to its square, and therefore what's really going on is the plus part of R and also just the plus part of the E's. And so let me call sigma plus or minus, say, let me just take sigma plus, just the plus part of E with G. So what is actually going on here in this action is the integral of sigma plus AB wedge R plus AB, which this being a function of omega plus. And let's drop the cosmological term for a minute. I'll come back to the cosmological term. Now, what Plobansky noticed, well, I don't know what Plobansky noticed. Let me say what was noticed more recently. Okay. Let me contrast that let me just go back to the beginning here. Can I erase here? Let me contrast that with a different action that we might have written. We might have considered, and while I'm writing it this way, let me remind you that any anti-symmetric pair of indices plus, we can trade for SU2 indices I equals 1, 2, 3, because this is really valued in SU2 left. So I can also notate this as sigma plus, notating it in SU2 I, which R plus I, which is a function of omega plus. So this is purely an object living in SU2. There's a contraction of two objects living in SU2. And they're purely in the left-handed part of SU2. And let me consider a different action. The different action is where instead of sigma, I might just have a two-form valued in SU2. So let VI just be a two-form valued in the Lie algebra of SU2. And consider the action and just consider that action. That action is because of the R, by this time in most people's notebooks, has become an F because of the relation to Yang-Mills theory. So this is often called the BF action. And just to not confuse you, I have not turned my R's into F's. Okay, but this is what's called the BF action. It was studied first by Ricardo Sain and Gary Horowitz independently. And this is a very simple theory. This is an exceedingly simple theory. Its equations of motion are Ri equals 0 and covariant derivative of B equals 0. And that is now, I've forgotten the fact that B is no longer related to E wedge G. B is just a 2 form. And this is a theory whose solutions are some B's which are covariantly constant under the covariant derivative, and the curvature of that covariant derivative is 0.
So how do you get these two equations?
I vary B. And I just get R equals 0, because this is just quadratic. This is just a quadratic action, so I have linear. Okay. It's not quite quadratic, because this is a term d omega plus omega plus omega. Okay. So this is actually a quadratic equation, and this is a quadratic equation.
How do you get the second one?
I vary the omega plus, and I get an integral by parts, so I get the derivative on the b, and it completes to a covariant derivative nicely. So this equation, this theory describes an SU2 connection, which used to be half the connection of space-time, but we no longer are saying that. Okay? And a two-form valued in the Lie algebra of SU2. And what you find is that the curvature of that connection is 0, and that two forms covariantly constant. Let me make it a little bit more interesting. Let me add a term quadratic in B. By the way, I forgot to say so, but this is a topological field theory. This is a theory which has no local degrees of freedom. And it has an interesting mathematical existence. It is related to some invariants. That is, the quantum theory constructed from this theory is related to some interesting invariants of four-dimensional manifolds. There's a whole side.
So you think this is not GR?
This is not GR, because curvature is 0.
That's a full curvature.
Curvature is 0. Okay. Now I'm going to, but it's an interesting theory in mathematician study. Now I'm going to add this cosmological constant term. And now this equation changes just in one thing. I get R equals lambda, B, and dB is equal to 0. So now I get this some connection. Its curvature is given by a two form, a set of three two forms, and those two forms are covariantly constant. Of course, the second equation follows from the first equation by the Bianchi identity. It follows that dr is 0 by the Bianchi identity, and therefore, by this first equation, dv has to be 0. So the second equation is really just for free. Okay. This is also a topological field theory. And for people who know what the following words mean, the topological invariants constructed from this topological field theory follow from those from the one I wrote down before, by taking the SU2 algebra and twisting it to a quantum group algebra, where the quantum group label is related to the cosmological constant. So, and everything is known about both of these quantum theories. They're both very interesting by now well-studied topological quantum group theories. Okay. So, our action for general relativity is almost of this form, except that sigma is really E wedge G, self-dual part. That is to say precisely, sigma I is really E0 wedge EI plus epsilon IJK EJ wedge EK to put the projection operator back in. But so the two theories are different, and this is general relativity, and this is a topological field theory. But they're closer than you might think. And why they're closer than you might think is because of something that Blavatsky discovered, and then it was rediscovered by Captain Theodore Jacobson in the late 80s, is that there's a simple equation you can impose on B such that its solutions are, there exists a frame field that is four one-form fields such that sigma is constructed from the E's in this manner. And that equation is BI wedge BJ, which is symmetric in I and J, trace free part, that is minus a third delta IJ, BK wedge BK is equal to zero. And these, if you count them, are five equations. Why? Because this is 3 by 3 symmetric matrices, but the trace is taken out. And these five equations have the solutions that there exists frame fields in space-time, that is, 16 degrees of freedom, such that the Vs are constructed in this manner from the E's. And to demonstrate that is also a homework problem. And let me give this key equation a name. Let me call it the G-class equation. Okay. So to demonstrate that, one way you just plug in, that is just write the B's as the function of the E's that I've written, and just plug in and show that this is satisfied. And then you need a more sophisticated argument to do the inverse, and that is in both Klavansky papers and Capovidal and Jacobson's papers.
So can you just add this little BK term to the action and view lambda as a Lagrange multiplier?
That's what I'm about to do. That's exactly what I'm about to do. May I do that? Let's see, we were here. Since I'm on the outline, let's so what Akin just suggested is I consider the following action. It's going to be a function of the E of the V's, of the omega pluses, and of some new Lagrange multipliers, which I'm going to call phi ij. And because I want a trace-free equation, phi ij are symmetric and trace-free. And then I considered the action, integral B wedge R plus, which is a function of omega plus, plus lambda over 2 BI wedge BI, minus a new term, phi IJ BI wedge BJ. And now consider this action.
What happens if I integrate here and above, integrate out B?
I'm going to do that for you. That's coming. Just shortly. Okay. From here, we move faster because we're getting simpler and simpler. Those of you who are worried about time. So what are the equations of motion now? The equations of motion are this equation, which comes from varying the action by the phi's. I still get this equation from varying by omega, and when I vary by the b's, I get R plus of omega plus I is equal to 5ij bj. And this is a two-form. It's three two-form equations. So it's 3 times 6 is 24 equations. Okay? Now, this is still the Einstein equations. How is this?
Relative
still?
Term.
What?
Relative term.
Yes, there is. Thank you.
And 3 times 6 is not 24.
Thank you. This is 18 equations. Thank you very much. Thank you. Good. It's great to have a good audience. Okay. What happens when I take these equations of motion? Well, you just go backwards through everything that we've been talking about. You solve these equations, you introduce the E's, okay. Then the E's go here and here. This equation is now d e where g is equal to 0, plus part is equal to 0, which we've already argued tells us that omega is the plus part of the connection gotten from the E's. This equation, then, is a piece of the Einstein equations. It's the piece of the Einstein equations that tells you that, well, what these guys become is the left-handed piece of the curvature tensor, and it tells you that they're given by two pieces, a term proportional to E where G, and a term proportional to E where G times some 5 coefficients. Those, and now there's, now the equations are getting simpler, but the derivations to check get longer. The thing that you now check is that these 5 objects are the left-handed part of the Weyl tensor. And this is the equation that says that the curvature tensor, the left-handed part of the curvature tensor, is given by a part proportional to sigma, plus a part proportional to the left-handed part of the Weyl tensor. And that means, in particular, that the Ricci tensor is not present. That is, there's a decomposition of the curvature tensor into Weyl and Ricci pieces. And this equation succinctly says the Ricci piece is absent. So this is the Einstein equation. That is, this implies that the Ricci tensor is 0.
So it's IIJ is like a Lagrange multiplier?
It's like a Lagrange multiplier, but they have a physical meaning. They are the left-handed part of the Weyl tensor. And if you know something about gravitation radiation theory, that's where the gravitation degrees of freedom live. That is, these are the left-handed polarized gravitational waves. So one has gotten a version of the Einstein equations in a very different language, but it's still just the good old Einstein equations. And I noticed something interesting at this point, which I think is ultra cool and ultra unappreciated, even by the people who appreciate this stuff. This action is cubic, which means all the equations of motion are quadratic equations. And that's the simplest form that a nonlinear theory can take. The simplest form that a nonlinear theory can take is when you unwind the nonlinearities by introducing auxiliary fields so that you reduce a small number of complicated equations to a larger number of quadratic equations. You can't go simpler than that because then it's no longer nonlinear. And that's what this set of variables accomplishes. Now, you mentioned integrating out for b's, so let me do that. Before I do that, the reason why I kept making a mistake that Malcolm caught, among the many mistakes I made that Malcolm caught, is really this lambda wants to be folded into the phi. So let me introduce another guy I'll call phi prime. No, let me not call phi prime, because then I'll screw up. Let me call it psi. Let me call psi ij phi ij plus, I think there's a one-third when you do it honestly, delta ij lambda. And then the trace of psi is equal to lambda. So the cosmological constant is just another name for the trace of this. And the variational principle, there are still 5 equations because you have to vary with this constraint imposed. And And the equations in motion are now just r plus I equals psi ij bj. Okay? Now I'm ready to get rid of the b's. I can invert so that as long as the determinant of psi is not zero, and because I put in when the cosmological constant is not zero, that's easier to arrange. And then I can write bi as psi inverse ij r plus j. And then my action principle is the integral of r plus I omega plus wedge r plus j, also of omega plus, times psi inverse ij. And that's an action principle for general relativity. It's a function of an SU2 connection through its curvature and a 3x3 symmetric traceless trace-fixed tensor. And it's no longer a polynomial because I have to take the inverse there. Okay. And this form is also known to capture the Del Jacobson. Yeah, around 88.
So you should vary with respect to phi. Or not?
Well, now you vary with respect to psi.
You do vary.
Yeah. And I'll leave it as a homework to show that you jump back up through these equations. Let me leave another homework. While you're doing that, what is the integral of r plus, which r plus just times psi? You might not take the inverse. What is that theory? Anybody, any guesses? Well, so this is a homework, but I'll tell you the answer. It's a homework to work it out. This is the self-dual Einstein equations. Okay. Now, I have a couple of promises that I have to keep. One of them is to put the I's back in for Lorentzian case. And then I erased the outline, but I think the next thing that I promise to do is De Sitter spacetime in this formulation. So that's what I will do, De Sitter spacetime. And then we'll see where we are in terms of time. Is everybody still happy to be here? You said 2 hours, but there's a lot of stuff here. Are we okay?
Yeah, if anyone who needs to leave, of course.
Or wants to, even if you don't need to.
Right, or wishes to leave. Everyone's holding you here. And the names of anyone who leaves early will be taken.
No, I won't even notice. In fact, there are as many people here as there are. Okay, what I would like actually to do, I'm going to postpone the I's, and what I would like to do is go to the Hamiltonian form, because to get to De Sitter spacetime, I could get there from here, but it's even easier from the Hamiltonian form. And what I'm going to do is go to the Hamiltonian form of general relativity from this form of the action principle. And I'm going to do it in 3 steps. Now, the Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity in the usual old-fashioned notation, J2, Dirac and Higgs and Arnold Desmond and Misner and other people, is horrendously ugly and complicated. And in several lectures to do it, you have to decompose and to lapse and shift. And there's a whole long, big, complicated story in geometry and so forth. Just some of you may know that story, some of you may not know that story. I'm going to just go from here. And I'm going to go from here to the Hamiltonian formulation in a few lines. And I hope this will, and then from that, we're going to look, find some obvious solutions of that Hamiltonian formulation. And that will be the obvious solution, the most obvious solution will be the Sitter space time. And we notice, and just keep in mind that the cosmological constant is related to psi this way. And so, and while I'm erasing, just remember, remind yourself of the basics of Hamiltonian dynamics, which is that you want to find out who the P's and Q's are, what the Poisson brackets are, and when you have gauge invariance, you have constraints. So we have a manifold here, which is of the form of some compact free manifold cross R. And therefore, I'm going to break the indices up, the space-time indices, mu, nu, et cetera, into zero, which represent time, and indices. And now I'm going to get into trouble. Let me call them A, B, C to represent the spatial manifold indices.
But how do you distinguish them now from the frame?
Yeah, so that's bad.
Maybe just use menu and say that they run from 1 to 3 or 9.
Fine. Well, I'll call an alpha, beta, gamma when I need them, and they run 1, 2, 3. And let me look at what this action is. And it's the integral epsilon 0 alpha beta gamma. And it is an R 0 alpha, which is a function of the omega plus. And it is a function R beta gamma. There's an I, there's a J, and there's a psi inverse IJ. And these R's are just like Yang-Mills fields. So what's living here? What's living inside of here is a guy that looks like del 0. I remember I called the omega pluses A, so let me remind you that AI is the same thing as omega plus I. And just think of that as a Yang-Mills field. So this is del 0 AI is here, minus del alpha A0, and there's also the covariance stuff, and I'm going to put the covariance stuff over here. And let me notice something interesting about this structure. There's only one time derivative. This is the only place there's a time derivative anyway. So it's very simple to parse who are going to be the canonical momenta and so forth. This action has the form of an integral del 0 A alpha, and anything that's the coefficient of that is going to be the momenta. So I'm just going to call that, and that has some index I, I'm just going to call that E, because electric fields are always momenta. Beta gamma I epsilon alpha beta gamma. But actually, I don't even need to do that. I can just, since I'm defining it, just has an upper index I alpha. It just has a structure like that. And then that's this term from the R0, and then there's the term where the derivatives, which are spatial derivatives only, act on the A0. And those of you who remember how this works in electromagnetism know A0 is a Lagrange multiplier. Why? There's no, because of the antisymmetry here, there's no time derivative on A0. So A0 is a Lagrange multiplier. I don't have any boundaries, so I can integrate this covariant derivative by parts. So I get minus, that minus turns into a plus. I get a zero alpha. And everything, sorry, a zero I, that's in an SC2 index. And what did the integral by parts go to? The integral by parts hits everything here. But everything here is already in the definition of the E. So the structure is just covariant derivative alpha E alpha I. And I just have to tell you who the E is. So the E alpha I is epsilon alpha beta gamma. That's the epsilon on the spatial three-dimensional manifold. R beta gamma J psi inverse I J. And so the action is just of the form of P Q dot, where the E's are playing the role of the momenta, minus a Lagrange multiplier A0 times the thing which is just the Gauss's law constraint, the same as in electromagnetism and Yang-Mills theory. So that's it. That's the theory in Hamiltonian form. And it appears almost entirely trivial. So there must be something I forgot to say. And let me just write another definition for completion, and then I'll say the thing that I forgot to say.
Indeed, just to be clear, are you saying that this is a reformulation of Euclidean Einstein gravity?
Yeah. The thing that I would like to say is that, let me simplify it even more. Let me call this object GI, and GI is just the covariant derivative of the momenta E alpha I. And this is looks just like a Gauss's law constraint in Yang-Mills theory, the electromagnetism. Okay. And I traded momenta. I defined what the canonical momenta are. That is, this, which defines the canonical momenta in terms of the size and the r's, which are functions of the a's, are what are called primary constraints. They're equations without derivatives that come from the definition of the momenta. That is, I define E alpha I as delta S delta A dot alpha I. And that's what these equations turn out to be. Now, in addition, there's some other constraints. There's the constraints to say that the momenta conjugate to the size are zero, and there's some constraints that say that the momenta conjugate to the A zero are zero. These are just like electromagnetism, and these are new. On the other hand, these don't cause any trouble, because I don't know, I've gotten rid of the size. The size are here in the definition of the momenta, and they don't exist in the action. So the Hamiltonian is just this term, which is proportional to a constraint, and there's the Gauss law constraint there, just the Gauss law constraint. So the theory looks entirely trivial. Okay, what have I left out? I have forgotten to say something.
Is the quadratic constraint?
The what?
Quadratic constraint.
Yeah, well, where is it?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Where is it?
I'm not here.
You do, because it's just like stuff that you know. In fact, you're the one person who should be able to guess this. Where it's hidden is that when I define the momentum in terms of the r's and the size,
the permanent should not.
Right, but it does if you take it. And the reason is that there are fewer E's than there are A's in size. So that, in fact, there are some conditions which hold just by virtue of this equation. And to figure out what they are, you just have to go back, just invert So if you invert, notice that we have a relation like this. What's basically happened is that the E's are the spatial part of these two forms B's. Basically, the E's are the B's pulled back to the three manifold, the spatial manifold, and then dualized there. And they give there, that gives you first a two form, pulling back the B's, which are two forms. That gives you two forms in the spatial manifold, and then you dualize in the spatial manifold, and that gives you a vector density. And these E's are vector densities, that is, there are two forms dualized with the epsilon, so they're really vector densities. The alpha has an index, and some people notate densities with twiddles. And in exchanging the E's for the R's, there are some degrees of freedom loss. That is, this can only be done if the R's satisfy some additional conditions. And it actually doesn't take very long to figure out what they are. And I'll just tell you so that I don't waste your time. Okay. One of them is to take the E's and contract it into the R's. And this is an object which has a free manifold index V, and it usually is labeled by the D. And why is this vanished? Well, if you invert this, then R is equal to psi times E. And so this is equal to E alpha, but there's an epsilon here, so it's really R alpha beta is equal to E gamma epsilon alpha beta gamma I j on psi j. So this is E alpha I E gamma j psi I j epsilon alpha beta gamma. The psi is symmetric, the epsilons make this combination of E's anti-symmetric, so this vanishes from the definition of the momenta. So we have some additional constraints, which are linear in the E and linear in the R's, in the R pluses. So we should add them to the action with some Lagrange multiplier. A Lagrange multiplier, this is a vector density, this is a two-form, so this is a density with an index downstairs. So I should multiply that by some vector field V alpha, P alpha, and I should add those to the action because all constraints are added to the action. Then there turns out to be one more, and that one more is called H. And that's epsilon ijk. I'll write it down and then I'll argue for it. E alpha I, E I beta, R ijk, alpha beta. So now I'm contracting in the alpha betas and alpha betas there. And if I, again, invert and put the R here, what I end up getting is a trace of psi times the determinant of E. But the trace of psi is fixed to be the cosmological constant. So this minus the cosmological constant times the determinant of E is zero as a function of the definition of the momenta. And that's another constraint. And so we add that to the action. And now I'm going to make some claims, which are more homework. One is that under the natural Poisson brackets here. So now, by the way, now I have completely gotten rid of the psi. So the psi's are no longer part of the story. I just have a Poisson bracket that have this has the A's and the E's, which are just like a three-dimensional Yang-Mills field. I have the Poisson brackets, so this is at some point X and point Y, delta 3 X Y, delta alpha beta, delta I J. And so under those Poisson brackets, the algebra here closes. And if you go back to all the correspondences to the general relativity variables, this turns out to be what are called the momentum constraints. And it can be shown that this generates diffeomorphisms of the three-dimensional spatial manifold sigma. And this is the Hamiltonian constraint. This is the nasty thing, which in the old-fashioned variables looks like 1 over square root of the determinant of the metric pi pi minus trace pi squared plus square root of the determinant of the metric times the Ricci scalar. This is when you go back through all the translation, the same as this.
Still, what about the fact that psi, the determinant of psi had to be non-zero? So all
so that is
eliminated. But it's in the functional integral, so it could be been zero.
Indeed.
So where does this reflect itself once you got rid of the psi?
Where it reflects itself is that the space of solutions of these equations is not quite, is larger than the space of solutions of the Einstein equations. The precise correspondent is that these electric fields are related to the B in the way that I said, and those are related to E wedge G in the way that I said. When everything is non-degenerate, the equations that you get here are the Einstein equations. But when things are degenerate, there's another solution set. And there's an interesting variety of structures there in the degenerate set, some of which has been explored and much of which has not been explored. Okay. So I promised you the sitter space time. But let me just notice that now I have a Hamiltonian formulation for general relativity in terms of SU2 Yang-Mills-like variables, that is the Yang-Mills-like connection in SU2 and its conjugate electric fields. All the equations are low-order polynomials, and this is the Ashtikar formulation. So what I've gotten to is what Ashtikar got to by a much more complicated route from the Arnowitz-Desmond-Misner formulation. But this is what are called the Ashtikar variables. Okay. Now, I've taken a lot of time and energy. There's a lot of stuff. I'm not trying to get the reward, but let me derive the sitter space time. And let me derive the sitter space time as a solution of these equations. And I'm just looking again for virgin blackboards I won't need. I'm going to slightly rewrite this equation. And I'm going to slightly rewrite it in the following form. I'm going to pull outside the E's. And then I'm going to put inside here FAB K, actually, epsilon IJK. Let me take that inside. I'm being indecisive. And keep it outside. And what's here is a lambda and is an epsilon. This is alpha beta, sorry. I have it. Alpha beta gamma, E gamma, K. So that's another name for that equation. Well, there's a bunch of solutions which stare at you right away. What are the solutions that stare at you? There's solutions where this bit is equal to zero all by itself. So let us consider solutions where, and I'll give that object a name. It's a two-form valued in SU2. So I'll call it J, alpha beta k, minus lambda, epsilon alpha beta, gamma, e gamma k is equal to zero. If you go back to these equations, these are actually R being proportional to B, and B is proportional to E when you pull back into the spatial manifold. So if you take these equations and pull them back into the spatial manifold, you get those equations plus the term in phi. What these equations imply is that the phi's are zero. And the phi's, I told you, are the Weyl curvature. So these are all the equations where the Weyl curvature is zero. And those of you who know something about the Sitter spacetime know that they are the unique solutions in the Lorentzian sector where the Weyl curvature is zero. That is, in terms of this notation, we're looking at the solutions where phi ij equals zero. So in terms of space-time, r plus I is equal to lambda times sigma plus I. Those are the De Sitter. So those are the conditions that define De Sitter space-time. And I just want to give you some explicit, make it totally explicit. If you want to make this totally explicit, you can consider coordinates where alpha, A alpha I is delta alpha I times the square root of lambda, say, over 3 times some function of time. And you plug these, so those give you an ansatz. You plug these in. And again, I'll leave this as a homework. You get equations that tell you that f dot is related to f, I believe, cubed. Sorry, f to the fourth. Times the lapse. The lapse is this equation here. You choose the lapse goes like 1 over f cubed. There's a square root of lambda over 3 here. And you find out that there is a gauge where f is equal to e to the time times the square root of lambda over 3. And you work through everything, and that is the Sitter space time. I'll leave that also as a homework. That is, eventually you get the metric, and it is a metric of the Sitter space time in the standard coordinates. Okay, so there is the Sitter space-time opinion here. Let me show you one last thing about the Sitter space-time, and then I'll stop. Supposing we wanted to get close to quantum theory. I'm not doing any quantum theory here, but usually the first step to quantum theory from any classical mechanics is looking at the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So let me, as a last thing to do, I'm just looking again at some blackboard. It'll take me less time to do this than to have everybody reorient themselves. Supposing I want to go to Hamilton-Jacobi theory. If I want to go to Hamilton-Jacobi theory, I ask, what's the configuration space? The configuration space is the space of SU2 connections on the spatial manifold sigma, which is three-dimensional compact spatial manifold. And so a Hamilton-Jacobi function is a function of an SU2 connection on this three-dimensional manifold. It should be, and what I'm looking for is I'm looking for pairs of A's and E's where E alpha I is the derivative of this Hamilton-Jacobi function by A alpha I by the SU2 connection. And I would like to solve the Gauss's law equation, this equation, and this equation. So let me do that. The Gauss's law equation says delta, says covariant derivative alpha, delta S, delta A, alpha I is zero. And that tells me that S is SU2 gauge invariant. This equation, I won't go through it because I have to do a few steps and people are looking tired. But this equation implies, so that equation d alpha equals zero implies that S is three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariant. So then finally, I have this equation. And let me look for special solutions of this form. Special solutions of this form tell me that delta S, delta A, alpha I, is related to epsilon alpha beta, sorry, upstairs in these scenes, alpha beta gamma, the curvature beta gamma, I with the constant, and let me put the constant in the right place, 1 over lambda, the cosmological constant. So I want a function of a three, of an SU2 connection on a three manifold, which has the property that it's gauge invariant and diffeomorphism invariant, and its derivative is equal to the curvature or the field strength of that connection. And there is only one solution of that, which is that S is the integral of the Chern-Simons invariant, which for people who don't know, I'll write on the nearby blackboard. But that is with a 1 over cosmological constant there. And for people who don't know it, this is a fascinating topological invariant, which is equal to the integral of A wedge, I'm going to write it in form notation, A wedge dA plus 2/3 A wedge A wedge A IJK epsilon IJK. And it happens to be a functional of the connection on the free manifold whose gradient is proportional to the field strength or curvature, and which is diffeomorphism invariant and gauge invariant. So what I've showed you is that the Chern-Simons invariant is the Hamilton-Jacobi function that in general relativity leads to de Sitter spacetime, or with the opposite sign, anti-decision space time.
Is this integrated in free space?
Yes, in free space. Okay, I think I should stop here. I can't resist saying this.